We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with The State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Let's start out as we always do with local and the ILWU.
Yes, this week the ILWU.
What
local,
is the ILWU?
It's the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. And the Local 19 said that they are going to bring a lawsuit to try to stop the third arena. They're going to file in King County Superior Court to challenge the memorandum of understanding between Chris Hansen, the City of Seattle, and King County. And the lawsuit charges that the environmental review of an alternative site is really a bogus one because Hansen has already bought about $51 million worth of land in the Soto area. And he has said from the beginning that he's not willing to build the arena anywhere else. So the environmental review of an alternative site that's required by state law is really, even if it goes forward, is not going to be taken seriously.
Sham, I believe, is the technical term.
Yeah. And so that's kind of an interesting development in this construction of a third arena in the Soto area.
So what are they asking for in that lawsuit?
To stop the construction of the third arena, probably to void the memorandum of understanding.
You know, I think in the 15 years we've been doing this show, we've seen three arenas built, and if we go another 15, we'll be talking about arena number 6.
Probably.
Well, actually, we should be getting pretty soon to the point, since it seems to be about a 20-year lifespan, where people will
yes.
be talking about where Safeco Field and what is it, Quest? No, it's Comcast, whatever the hell the state football stadium is now called, that they're getting old and they're run down, and we really need two new state-of-the-art stadiums.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Set your watch. It'll be about 3 more years before that starts.
All right. Synchronizing watches now. Let's move on to...
Isn't this a cheerful show?
A study that came out this week or was revealed about marijuana arrests in Washington.
Yeah, a City University of New York study was released this week on the costs of marijuana arrests in Washington State over the last 25 years. They looked at arrest records from 1986 to 2010, and they included the costs for police and court costs, but they excluded the cost of criminal defense representation and court fines. In other words, it's the cost that the taxpayers would bear, not that the defendants would bear. And their conservative estimate was about $305 to $306 million over the last 25 years.
And bear in mind, it's not just the financial cost that defendants and people caught up in this pay. It's also, you know, lost jobs and wages, ruined lives, et cetera.
Yeah, and, you know, it can stand in the way of future employment, too. If your future employer does a criminal background check, that arrest record's going to pop up because that doesn't just get expunged if you're not convicted of a crime. So that's hanging out there on you if you have to rent, if you need to get a loan, if you have any kind of a background check for any reason. It stays with you wherever you go for a long time.
Yeah, and especially if you're a young person with youth unemployment being what it is, that's a huge barrier for a lot of people now.
Yeah. So just in even just the taxpayer costs, $305 million is a sizable chunk of money and could be used to, maybe go after some bigger fish. I'm thinking in terms of say banks and mortgage companies and some of the crimes they've committed over the last 10 years.
Or even if you want to talk about peddling drugs, I mean, what about Big Pharma?
Yeah.
That would keep them quite busy.
And oh yes, but don't forget there is a legalization initiative on the ballot. So
yes, so,
keep that
so,
in mind.
So vote.
Yes,
in November.
And we'll mention this at the end of the show also. But Eat the State's coming out with its endorsement issue this coming week, and we'll be covering our recommendations for the election in the next couple weeks on this show.
Yeah, and there was some more campaign news this week too. I like to look not so much at the, you know, back and forth between the candidates, but I like to look at where the money goes in campaigns
and where it comes from.
Yeah, and where it's coming from. And this week two campaigns got very, very large donations. The Charter School Initiative I-1240 got $2 million from Bill Gates and $1.1 million from Alice Walton. She's the Walmart heir. And
both of whom have financial interests in the
privatization
of schools movement.
Yeah, and so far the Pro-1240 campaign, the pro-charter school campaign, has raised about $8.3 million versus about $277,000 for the anti charter school initiative. So I guess they think that by outspending the anti-charter school folks about 40-1, that they may actually be able to win this time around.
So just like it's a good idea to be able to sell liquor, now we can sell school children. Is that the
analogy? Because, you know, one of the things about the charter school, the pro-charter school the pro-charter school campaign that's been bothering me too are the TV ads they're running where they're saying, you know, charter schools have a proven record of serving students better. That's actually not true. The record for charter schools is about the same as the record for public schools. There's really no difference in terms of how well they serve children. The difference is that charter schools allow the privatization of public schools. That's the main difference. And it's mostly, as Job hinted, mostly a commercialization of education process that we're talking about here. And then
that in turn also drains money from public schools.
Yeah, from public funding of schools. Now, the other campaign I want to talk about this week, too, is the Republican State Leadership Committee has now dumped a total of $2.4 million by putting another million or so into the state attorney general's race. They put about $2.5 million into that race to support Reagan Dunn. And they've been running attack ads against Bob Ferguson, the Democratic challenger. One that's really gotten on my nerves is the one that accuses Ferguson of supporting cop killers. Now, this refers to 20 years ago when Ferguson was in law school and he was working as an intern. He helped to provide legal representation to death row inmates, which is a worthy cause in itself. And Ferguson admits, too, that he is against the death penalty and really folks should not be holding that against him.
That's a scandal. He's against the death penalty.
Yeah.
Like many people in this state.
Exactly. And the Republicans have seized on the fact that one of the folks that he helped get legal representation for, who was on death row, had been convicted of killing a police officer. So that's not exactly the same as the tone of the commercial that's running,
because it's extremely dishonest.
Because
we all know that if you're convicted of a heinous crime, therefore you're not entitled to legal
representation. To any legal representation, which flies against the U.S. Constitution. So we should be trying at least a little bit to clear the air in terms of the facts behind that particularly bad attack ad.
Yeah, should Reagan Dunn win the race for attorney general this year, just about the same time they'll be talking about replacing Safeco Field, you're also going to be having the Reagan Dunn for U.S. Senate campaign.
Oh, yeah, probably.
All right. Well, let's move on to national and talking about legal representation. The telecom companies came up before Supreme Court.
Yeah, and here's a shock. They did quite well. The United States Supreme Court, very quietly, given that all the political reporting and news this week was focused on the presidential election, refused to hear and refused to take on and reverse a lower court ruling, let stand a ruling that Congress was, in fact, entitled to retroactively shield telecommunication companies from lawsuits and vulnerability for their cooperation with warrantless NSA spying under the Bush administration. Now, people may remember back in 2008, warrantless spying was a huge controversy in the Bush administration. In 2008, Republican-controlled Congress went ahead and voted to not only legalize warrantless spying by the No Such Agency, but also to retroactively legalize it, and therefore to shield the various telecommunications companies that cooperated with the NSA from various lawsuits that were being prosecuted against it. Now, folks may remember that after promising as a presidential candidate to oppose that, then Senator Obama actually voted in favor of the FISA Amendments Act, which was the legislation in question. As president, he has continued the Bush administration policy of refusing to confirm or deny whether warrantless spying is continuing, but it's a pretty good bet that it is. There's a lot of evidence that it is. And the FISA Amendments Act
just say if it's possible and it's not prohibited, the government is going to try to do it.
And if it's possible and it is prohibited, you know, it's about
50-50. The government
50-50.
May be doing it.
Exactly.
Yes.
So the FISA Amendments Act, however, was only done for 4 years. So it actually comes up for renewal in December in the lame duck session after the elections this time. So what kind of pressure is brought to bear may have a lot to say with whether Democrats and Republicans can be made to oppose this infringement on civil liberties. There is one additional lawsuit that is still winding its way through the courts from the Electronic Freedom Foundation, and the Supreme Court is going to hear that case in December on the legality of warrantless wiretapping itself. But the telecommunications immunity from cooperating with that is now settled law in the United States.
All right. Continue with our cheerful news items for the week. Moving on to the vice presidential debate this week.
Yeah, that actually was fairly cheerful as Bill Mayer had the best comment of the whole thing with a tweet during the event of call 911. There's an old man beating a child on TV, and that really was just about it. And it's been very interesting to watch the mainstream or corporate media and Beltway pundit reaction to the vice presidential debate on Thursday between Vice President Joe Biden and Vice President wannabe Paul Ryan. Biden was spent much of his time laughing and smirking and generally being condescending and interrupting Ryan, and he did it because he was dismantling everything Ryan said point by point and really not leaving him much of an argument.
Some of us considered that to be an appropriate response to,
I think, as
a vice president.
I actually think that kind of ridicule is something that a lot of people have been waiting a long time to see any high-level elected official do. Just to put the sheer ridiculousness of a lot of the Republican talking points in national politics right now into their proper context, which is that they're not only stunningly dishonest but absurd
and divorced from reality
and completely divorced from reality, which is why we have this week in the alternate universe, which we'll get to in a minute. But it's been very interesting that unlike last week when Romney's being aggressive in the first presidential debate meant that he won the debate, Biden's being aggressive meant that he was a draw, because he was and the way this has generally been formulated is that Biden did better on substance, but that's not really how we decide debates. We decide debates by body language, and people were alienated by the fact that Biden was so rude.
What it tells me is Biden loves a good scrap, and I like that as much as other people. And, you know, I think, Job, you told me on the phone last night that the thing about political debates is when they're at their best, they resemble reality TV. And as everyone knows, in a reality TV show, the most popular character is always the one who is arrogant, forthright, and who likes a good scrap. And to me, that means Biden won the debate hands down, not just on substance, but also on style.
Well, and I would add to that, you know, for most people who only casually follow politics and, you know, presidential elections every 4 years is really about the only time they pay attention. But they also see things while they're flipping past on TV on their way to see Jersey Shore or whatever. For the last 30 years, most of what people have seen on TV that passes for political debate is shouting talking heads.
Yes.
You know, shouting over each other. And, you know, people out in the real world now who are not, you know, high-level, well-paid Beltway journalists who will all hang out with each other at Georgetown parties, that's how they associate political debate. So I don't think people took offense particularly at all, unless it was their guy that was being made fun of.
Yeah.
But it, again, does show kind of a double standard where when Democrats are not aggressive, you know, they're rolling over and they're wimps. And then when they are aggressive, well, they're rude and we can't have that. So it'll be interesting to see which tack Obama takes this coming week and the week after for the final two presidential debates.
Yeah.
All right. Well, from there on to this week in the alternate universe.
Yeah, we had, speaking of the presidential debates, Steve Bannon over at Rachel Maddow's blog on MSNBC has been doing a weekly feature the entire year where he lists the mendacities, the lies of Willard Romney on the campaign trail each week, and he had a record number this past week, 50 of them, many of which occurred in the presidential debate itself.
But didn't have to dig very deep for them either.
No. And some of them, of course, are repeat lies from week to week. But there was a new one last week that has caused a bit of a waves, and it has to do with a gentleman named Glenn Doherty, who is one of the people that died in the Benghazi terrorist attack in Libya a few weeks ago.
One of the security personnel.
Yeah, exactly. And Romney was saying, well, I knew Glenn Doherty, and he was a neighbor, and I was just shocked and horrified when I heard that he died, and I took this very personally, and, you know, went on to the criticisms that Republicans have been making recently about the Obama administration's handling of that. But it turns out that, Mitt Romney did know Glenn Doherty, kind of. What happened was that the Romneys, when they were in their Lahala, that is San Diego house,
La Jolla,
in 2010, they got a card left on their door inviting them to a Christmas party by a neighbor, and they decided, well, we don't know these people, we're not interested in that, and threw it away. But then they saw that there were a whole bunch of cars parked across the street and figured, oh, well, it's right nearby, well, why don't we go over and say hi? Well, it turned out that was Glenn Doherty's house, and it was the wrong party. They crashed the party. And not only did they crash the party, but according to a number of the guests that have been interviewed this week as a result of Romney using Doherty on the campaign trail, that Romney stayed for like an hour and a half at a party he was not invited to, and basically went around shaking hands and introducing himself like he was on the campaign trail, and met Doherty at least four times, and didn't remember from time to time who he was, or let alone that he was the host or what his name was, and basically alienated everybody at the party who you know more or less applauded when the Romneys left finally. And so here you have Romney 2 years later politicizing this guy's gift and saying he knows him. And so now the family is outraged that Romney is using this imaginary relationship with a guy's party that he crashed once, and he couldn't remember 20 minutes after the first time he met him, and saying that he remembered him 2 years later. So that's Mitt Romney's presidential campaign in a nutshell. The other interesting phenomenon that we had in the alternate universe this week, frequently we have various Republican state representatives saying idiotic things, but this time we have kind of a battle of the band situation between Wisconsin State Representative Roger Rivard and Arkansas State Representative John Hubbard. First, we have Rivard, who got in a fair amount of trouble this week for recounting sage advice that he had got from his father when he was a young man and you know considering dating before marriage and so forth, and recounting his father telling him, "Just remember, Roger, some girls they rape so easy."
Oh God.
Now, what he was trying to say was that if you sleep with a girl and you know that she might accuse you of rape in the morning, so you have to be careful of these creatures,
these females.
they'll lie at the drop of a hat. But it kind of came out a little wrong. Of course, you know, he doubled down on the underage girls are, you know, compulsive liars about sexual assault as soon as he was questioned on this. But, fortunately, he was overshadowed a little bit by, Representative Hubbard, who released his new book. If by book you mean spittle with a binding attached. Thank you, Charlie Pierce, for that line. Commenting on the glorious history of the Confederacy, talking about, and this is a direct quote, "The institution of slavery that the black race has long believed to be an abomination upon its people may actually have been a blessing in disguise. The blacks who could have endured these conditions and circumstances would someday be rewarded with citizenship in the greatest nation ever established upon the face of the earth." So, if you endured this particular institution for 400 years, which would make you rather long-lived, you could then be bestowed with citizenship in a country that denied you the right to vote and other basic rights for another 100 years. We should all be so lucky.
Yeah,
that is the alternate universe.
Now visits on you the highest rates of imprisonment of any minority population in the world, as well as having repealed things like affirmative action,
No, we live in a colorblind society now. Haven't you got the memo?
Right. And I'm sure there are a lot of African Americans who would like to talk about the drug war as well.
Yeah. And Latinos. And Latinos, too.
And how it's devastated their communities.
Yeah.
But
and, you know, if you were listening to the 7:30 segment, we were talking about Roots of the Young Adult Homeless Shelter in the U District. 50% of the young adults who show up at that shelter are people of color.
Yeah.
And that's a very much an economic issue.
All right, let's move on and cover the Cyber Pearl Harbor.
Cyber Pearl Harbor, yeah. The U.S. Secretary of Defense this week, Leon Panetta, gave a speech at the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum in New York. And at that speech, he made the statement that the U.S. may come under attack, a cyber warfare attack by another nation or a group of hacktivists, and he called it a potential cyber Pearl Harbor.
Except it'd be retaliation, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes, it would. It would be the result of our own cyber warfare program, which is codenamed Olympic Games, and which has gotten very little coverage in the U.S. media. And what's interesting is that Panetta and, well, not just Panetta, but the whole Obama administration is proposing that Congress pass legislation that would force U.S. companies to share their cybersecurity information with the U.S. government and coordinate on cybersecurity. But they're also talking about the U.S. developing a first strike capability, very similar to the kinds of stuff we were talking about during the Cold War
weapons. On that legislation, because they couldn't get it passed before Congress adjourned for the election, they're now talking about trying to do the same thing by issuing regulations.
Yeah, by issuing a presidential executive order to force businesses to try to coordinate with the U.S. government on cybersecurity. Now, currently, the Department of Defense is preparing what they call rules of engagement for cyber warfare. And I just want to remind folks that none of this would be happening if it weren't for the U.S. cyber warfare program, which has been targeting Iran now for many years and possibly other targets as well.
I believe the rules of engagement at this point are let's hit first.
Yeah.
Because that's what's already happened in a number of cases. We've launched numerous cyber warfare attacks in the last 5 years.
Well, and it was the same with nuclear weapons, too. We developed the first bomb. We used it first. And then, of course, the Cold War happened afterwards. It's the same situation. We developed the means to engage in cyber warfare. We've used it already, and now we're talking about having to develop first strike capabilities, which we've already done, and we're talking about having to develop this very large infrastructure of defense now. So it's very much a cyber Cold War that's developing. I also want to mention, too, this week, the city of Oakland is doing something that is unusual, and it's the first time it's happened in the U.S. They are suing to prevent the closure of a medical marijuana dispensary by the Department of Justice. So the city of Oakland is basically telling the federal government, no, don't come here. Don't enforce federal law when we have a state law that allows medical marijuana in our state. We don't want you to seize the assets of this medical marijuana dispensary. And we are suing in court to prevent that. They say that they're acting on behalf of medical marijuana patients, and they seek to, quote, restrain and declare unlawful the forfeiture proceedings that the Department of Justice is undergoing. The Oakland City Council has voted to approve the lawsuit, so it isn't just the city of the mayor's office that is pursuing this. This dispensary is probably the largest medical marijuana dispensary in the United States. It serves about 600 to 800 customers per day, and it pays about $3.5 million in taxes. Total, about $1 million of that goes to the city. So it's a major business in the city of Oakland, and they're standing up for it, which I think is a pretty good sign.
And given that the Department of Justice has been similarly cracking down in a number of states that have medical marijuana laws, including Washington State.
And in California, the Department of Justice has forced about a third of the medical marijuana dispensaries in the state to close down. This is a very interesting fight back by the city of Oakland.
Yeah, and other cities could do that too, not naming any names.
Yes.
All right. Moving on to international, starting with Libya.
Yeah, this week in Libya, the parliament voted to dismiss Prime Minister Mustafa Abu Shagour, who's only been in power for about a month. He's only been in office for maybe a little under a month. Meanwhile, there's nobody in the wings really to replace him yet, and Libya has no defense or interior ministers, no police force, and no military, and the Libyan government therefore has no ability to arrest or bring to trial the militia members who are responsible for the attack on the U.S. embassy in Benghazi or the death of the U.S. ambassador J. Christopher Stevens. So it isn't just the Obama administration's fault that there's been nobody captured and put on trial for the death of the U.S. ambassador. Also, it is the Libyan government, such as it exists. It is only pretty much a small and powerless Congress.
It's a shell, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can be sure that there are covert forces on the ground trying to capture those people. And if that happens, and there are press accounts of it, they are probably lying about what actually happened, because that's been the pattern.
Right. Yeah. And then Leon Panetta, again, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, announced this week that the U.S. is sending troops to Jordan to help man the Jordan-Syria border. And we can view this either as, we're helping an ally, or we can view it as what it actually is. It's a slow U.S. military buildup to get involved in what's going to eventually become a regional war. The U.S. is also helping to build a base in Jordan near the border. Once again, another U.S. base being constructed in a foreign country. And in the meantime, Turkey and Syria are continuing to exchange fire across their border. So if you are seeing parallels to the buildup in the war in Vietnam with this, then you're not the only one.
I don't think we build bases here in the U.S. anymore.
we're trying to ramp down and close some of the bases here in the U.S.
And finally, Venezuela.
Yeah, Venezuela held elections last Sunday. This after a weeks and weeks of terrible media coverage in the U.S. about the dictator Hugo Chavez and how this election was going to be fraudulent and he was trying to buy off support for the election and yada yada yada. Well, as it turns out, they were very clean elections. Chavez won with 54% of the vote to 44% for the business candidate Enrique Cabrillas. And his party also won, Cabrillas' party, that is, also won only 3 out of the 24 different state-level governorships. So it looks a lot like the business party does not have a lot of popular support here. Now, this will be the 3rd presidential term for Chavez, which, you know, is certainly more than is the tradition in the U.S., and there are some things that that Chavez that have done that have been a little dubious, but that doesn't even begin to justify the kind of media reporting that happened both before and after this election. It was a clean election in Venezuela. It was certified as such by international monitors. You certainly didn't have any finagling of the voter registration rolls. You didn't have any voter suppression at the polling places themselves. You didn't have any questions about the accuracy of counts of voting machines or the availability of voting machines. People were actually able to vote. They cast their votes, and their votes were counted, and that was the result. We could actually learn a few things from that terrible, awful dictatorship in South America.
All right. Events.
Several of them coming up this week. Starting this morning at 10 o'clock, Lake Forest Park for Peace is having a March for Peace commemorating yet another anniversary of our invasion and occupation of Afghanistan. That will start at 10 at Ballinger Way Northeast and 15th Avenue Northeast in Lake Forest Park and go down Ballinger Village to Ballinger and Bothell Ways Northeast. Also today from 1 to 4 o'clock, the Washington Coalition Against the Death Penalty will be having this annual summit and dinner and fundraiser that will be at St. Margaret's Episcopal Church, 4228 Factoria Boulevard Southeast in Bellevue. On Wednesday, October 17th, from 11:30 until 4 p.m., annual conference, The Political Will to End Homelessness. That will be at St. Mark's Cathedral, 1245 10th Avenue East on North Capitol Hill. That's $30 ability to pay registration, which means if you can't afford the $30, that's okay. They want you to come. That includes lunch, by the way, and information on all the speakers and things I'll be talking about is at www.itfhomeless.org. And then also on Wednesday the 17th from 7:30 until 9 o'clock, Marriage Equality is Blessed by God is the name of the very timely forum that's going to be held at the Common Good Cafe, University Temple United Methodist Church at 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District.
And has anybody seen the commercials with Rich in them? With
no.
Reverend Rich in them?
TV commercials.
Oh, awesome. Yes. I had not seen that.
Supporting this.
Rich Lang is the pastor at that church.
Famous, huh?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Rich is quite the community activist, and he's taking a stand on this issue, which is good for him.
Fabulous.
Particularly when you have Catholic parishes and the Catholic Archdiocese actively campaigning
against gay
marriage equality. Yeah.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchuk, both with you at the State. And where do people find you at the State?
Well, as of Wednesday, you'll be able to find it wherever you find free publications, because once again, we're doing our annual print edition of our election endorsements and various other snarky coverage and opinions and news you might not get elsewhere. You can also find us online at www.eatthestate.org.
And you can find more of my material at mariatomchuk.com.